Bartimaeus, Chapter 28. To my great relief, the boy appeared to learn something from our close shave in the old town square. I saw no more of the casual English tourist now. Instead, for the rest of that dark, uncomfortable evening, he allowed me to guide him through Prague's maze of crumbling alleys in the appropriate manner, the stealthy, painstaking progress of two spies abroad in an enemy land. We made our way north with infinite patience, dodging the foot patrols that were now radiating out from the square by enmeshing ourselves under concealments, or on occasion entering derelict buildings to skulk as the soldiery tramped by. We were aided by darkness and the comparative scarcity of magical pursuit. A few foliots tripped across the rooftops, flashing out questing pulses, but I diverted these easily without detection. Beyond that, there was nothing. No demi-afrites unleashed, no djinn of any capacity. Prague's leaders were heavily reliant on their unobservant human troops, and of this I took full advantage. Less than an hour after we had begun our flight, we had crossed the Vltava on the back of a vegetable lorry, and were making our way on foot through a region of gardens towards the castle. In the great days of the Empire, the low hill on which the castle stood had been illuminated each day at dusk by a thousand lanterns. These changed colour, and occasionally position, at the Emperor's whim, casting multifarious light upon the trees and houses clinging to its slopes. Each lantern contained a sealed glass pod, in which an irritable imp resided. The master of lamps, an hereditary official among the court magicians, stalked along the hillside each afternoon, instructing his captives in the colours and intensity required for the night to come. By subtle phrasing of each charge, the nuances achieved could be subtle or spectacular, but were always in accordance with the mood at court. Now the lamps were broken and rusted to their posts. Except for a few feeble orange spots that marked out windows, Castle Hill was dark before us, enfolded by night. We came at length to the base of a steep flight of cobbled steps. Up above was Golden Lane. I glimpsed its lights, glinting high against the stars, on the very edge of the cold black slab of hill. Beside the bottom of the steps was a low wall, and behind this was a midden. I left Nathaniel lurking there, while I flew as a bat on a quick reconnaissance up the steps. The eastern steps had changed little since that distant day when my master's death had released me from his service. Too much to hope that an afrit would leap out to grab my current master now. The only presences I could detect were three fat owls hidden in the avenues of dark trees on either side of the way. I double-checked. They were owls, even on the seventh plane. Far off across the river, the hunt was still in operation. I could hear soldiers' whistles shrilling with sad futility, a sound that gave a thrill to my essence. Why? Because Bartimaeus was too fast for them, that's why. Because the jinni they wanted was far away already, flitting and flapping the 256 steps up Castle Hill. And because somewhere ahead of me, in the night silence, was the source of the disturbance that I still felt tingling on each plane, the odd, unidentified magical activity. Things were going to get interesting. The bat passed the tumbled husk of the old black tower, once occupied by the elite guard, but home now to no one but a dozen sleeping ravens. Beyond it was my objective. A street, narrow and unassuming, walled by a series of humble cottages, all tall stained chimneys, small windows, cracked plaster fronts, and plain wooden doors leading straight onto the road. The place was always like this, even in the great years. Golden Lane worked under different rules. The roofs, always sagging, were now beyond repair, a mess of warped frames and loose tiles. I settled on an exposed rib of wood on the endmost cottage and surveyed the street. In the days of Rudolf, greediest of the emperors, Golden Lane was a centre of great magical effort, the objective of which was nothing less than the creation of the Philosopher's Stone. A fabled pebble, accredited with the ability to turn base metals into gold or silver. Its existence is, of course, utter moonshine, as might be discovered by asking any imp. We djinn can alter the appearance of things by casting a glamour or an illusion, but to permanently shift the true nature of something is quite impossible. But humans never listen to something that doesn't suit them, and countless lives were expended on this futile search. Each house was rented to a different alchemist, and for a time the tiny cottages hummed with activity. The magicians came from all over the known world, from Spain, from Britain, from snowbound Russia, from the fringes of the Indian deserts, in the hope of winning incalculable reward. Each was master of 100 arts, each the tormentor of 12 jinn. Each drove their slaves for years in the great quest. Each in turn failed utterly. One by one their beards turned grey, their hands weak and palsied, their robes faded and discoloured from ceaseless summonings and experiments. One by one they tried to give up their position, only to find Rudolph was unwilling to let them go. Those who attempted to slip away found soldiers waiting for them on the castle steps. Others, attempting a magical departure, discovered a strong nexus around the castle, sealing them in. They did not escape. Many ended in the dungeons. The rest took their own lives. It was, to those of us spirits who watched the process, a deeply moral tale. Our captors had been caught in the prison of their own ambitions. Even after the search was abandoned, the street remained home to foreign magicians working for the Czechs. The government wanted them close beside the castle, where it could keep an eye on them. And so the situation remained, right through to the bloody night when Gladstone's forces took the city. No foreign magicians dwelled here now. The buildings were smaller than I remembered, huddled together like seabirds on a headland. I sensed the old magics, still seeped into the stonework, but little that was new. Except the faint tremoring on the plains was stronger now, its source much closer. The bat looked about carefully. What could it see? A dog ferreting in a hole at the foot of one old wall, a lit window fringed by thin curtains. Inside it an old man hunched beside a fire, a young woman in the glare of a street lamp walking carefully along the cobbles in high-heeled shoes, perhaps making for the castle. Blank windows, shut casements, roof holes and broken chimneys, litter blowing in the wind. An upbeat scene. And number 13, halfway down the street, a hovel indistinguishable from the rest in its griminess and melancholy, but with a glowing green nexus of force surrounding it on the sixth plane. Someone was in, and that someone did not want to be disturbed. The bat made a quick sortie up and down the street, carefully avoiding the nexus where it curved up into the air. The rest of Golden Lane was dark and quiet, fully obsessed with its little activities of evening. I swooped quickly back the way I had come, down to the bottom of the hill to rouse my master. "I found the place," I said. "Mild defences, but we should be able to get in. Hurry, while no one's around." I've said it before, but humans are simply useless when it comes to getting around. The time it took for that boy to climb those measly 256 steps! The sheer number of huffs and puffs and gratuitous pauses for breath he needed! The remarkable colour he went! I've never seen the like! "I wish we'd brought a paper bag or something," I told him. "Your face is glowing so much it can probably be seen from the other side of the Vltava. It's not even a very big hill."
"What kind of defences are there?"
His mind was strictly on the job. "Flimsy nexus," I said. "No problem. Don't you exercise at all?"
"No. No time. Too busy."
"Of course. You're too important now. I forgot." After 10 minutes or so we reached the ruined tower, and I became Ptolemy again. In this guise I led the way to a place where a shallow incline dropped down onto the street. Here, while my master gasped and wheezed gently against the wall, we looked out at the hovels of Golden Lane. "Appalling lack of condition," I commented.
"Yes, they should knock them all down and start again."
"I was talking about you."
Which one is it?"
"Number 13. That one on the right, three along, white plaster front. When you've finished dying, we'll see what we can do." A cautious walk along the shadows of the lane took us to within a few metres of the cottage. My master was all for marching up to the front door. I reached out an arm. "Stop right there. The nexus is directly in front of you. A fingertip further and you'll set it off." He stopped.
"You think you could get inside?"
"I don't think, boy. I know. I was doing this kind of stuff when Babylon was a small-time cattle station. Stand aside, watch, and learn." I stepped up to the frail, glowing net of filaments that blocked our way, bent my head close. I chose a small hole between the threads and blew gently towards it. My aim was true. The tiny sliver of obedient breath, a type of conjuration formed by an expiration of air from the mouth and a magic sign, not remotely connected to the noisome wind which is created in a rather different way, passed into the hole and hung there, neither slipping through nor withdrawing. It was too light to trigger the alarm. The rest was easy. I expanded the sliver slowly, gently. As it grew, it prized apart the filaments. In a few minutes, a large round hole had been created in the net, not far above the ground. I remodeled the breath into the shape of a hoop, and stepped nonchalantly through it. "There," I said. "Your turn." The boy frowned. "To do what? I still can't see anything." With some exasperation, I refigured the breath to make it visible on the second plane. "Happy now?" I said. "Just step carefully through that hoop." He did so, but still seemed unimpressed. "Huh," he said. "You could be making this up, for all I know." "It's not my fault humans are so blind," I snapped. "Yet again you're taking my expertise for granted. 5,000 years of experience at your command, and not even a thank you comes my way. Fine. If you don't believe there's a nexus there, I'll happily set it off for you. You'll see the magician Kavka come running."
"No, no." He was hasty now. "I believe you."
"Are you sure?" My finger hovered back towards the glowing lines.
"Yes, calm down. Now we'll creep in at a window and catch him unawares."
"Fine. After you." He stepped grimly forward, straight into the lines of a second nexus I hadn't noticed. Very subtle it was. Seventh plane only, the thinnest of thin threads. Anyone could have missed it. A loud siren noise, seemingly consisting of a dozen bells and chiming clocks, went off in the house. The noise continued for several seconds. Nathaniel looked at me. I looked at Nathaniel. Before either of us reacted, the noise was discontinued, and a rattling noise sounded behind the cottage door. The door was flung open, and a tall, wild-eyed man wearing a skullcap rushed out, shouting furiously. He didn't just have a skullcap on. He had other clothes as well, just in case you were getting excited. Look, I'll get to the details later. It's a narrative momentum thing.
"I told you," he cried. "This is too early. It will not be ready until dawn. Will you not leave me in pe—" "Oh!"
He took heed of us for the first time.
"What the devil?"
"Close," I said. "Kind of depends on your point of view." I leaped forward and grappled him to the ground. In an instant his hands were up behind of his back and nicely tied by the cord of his dressing gown. See? He had a dressing gown on as well, and pyjamas, for that matter. Perfectly respectable. This was to prevent any quick hand gestures that might have summoned something to his aid, also the rude ones, which might have upset the kid. His mouth was stuffed with a section of Nathaniel's shirt, in case of uttered commands. This done, I bundled him to his feet, and had him back indoors before my master could even open his mouth to speak an order. That's how fast a jinni can act when necessary. "Look at that," I said proudly. "Not even any noticeable violence." My master blinked.
"You've ruined my shirt," he said. "You've torn it in half."
"Shame," I said. "Now close the door. We can discuss this inside." With the door closed, we were able to take stock of our surroundings. Mr. Kavka's house could best be described by the term scholarly squalor. The entire floor, and every item of furniture within it, was covered with books and loose manuscripts. In places they formed intricate strata many inches thick. These in turn were covered with a thin crust of dust, scatterings of pens and quills, and numerous dark and pungent items, which had the nasty look of being leftovers from the magician's lunches over the preceding month or two. Beneath all this was a large work-table, a chair, a leather sofa, and in the corner a primitive rectangular sink with a single tap. A few stray parchments had migrated into the sink, too. It seemed that this particular floor of the cottage was entirely taken up by the one room. A window at the back looked down onto the hillside and the night. Lights from the city far below shone dimly through the glass. A wooden ladder extended up through a hole in the ceiling, presumably to a bedchamber. It did not look as if the magician had gone that way for some time. On close inspection, his eyes were grey-rimmed, his cheeks yellow with fatigue. He was also extremely thin, standing with crumpled posture, as if all energy had drained out of him. Not a particularly imposing sight, then, either the magician or his room. Yet this was the source of the trembling on the seven planes. I felt it stronger than ever. It made my teeth rattle in my gums.
"Sit him down," my master said. "The sofa will do. Push that rubbish out of the way." "Right."
He sat himself on a corner of the work-table, one leg on the floor, the other dangling casually.
"Now," he continued, addressing his captive smoothly in Czech, "I haven't much time, Mr. Kavka. I hope you will cooperate with me."
The magician gazed at him with his tired eyes. He gave a noticeable shrug.
"I warn you," the boy went on, "I am a magician of great power. I control many terrifying entities. This being you see before you—here I rolled my shoulders back and puffed my chest up menacingly—is but the meanest and least impressive of my slaves."
Here I slumped my shoulders and stuck my stomach out.
"If you do not give me the information I desire, it will be the worse for you."
Mr. Kavka made an incoherent noise. He nodded his head and rolled his eyes. The boy looked at me.
"What's that mean, do you think?"
"How do I know? I suggest taking off the gag and finding out."
"All right. But if he utters one syllable of any kind of spell, destroy him instantly."
To accompany this, the boy attempted an expression of terrible malignity that made him look as if he had an ulcer. I removed the gag. The magician coughed and spluttered for a time. He was no more coherent than before. Nathaniel rapped his knuckles on an exposed bit of table.
"Pay attention, Mr. Kavka. I want you to listen very carefully to all my questions. Silence, I warn you, will get you nowhere. To begin..."
"I know why you have come!"
The voice erupted from the magician's mouth with all the force of a river in spate. It was defiant, aggrieved, endlessly weary.
"You do not need to tell me. It is the manuscript, of course. How could it be anything else, when I have applied my all to its mysteries for the last 6 months? It has eaten up my life during this time. See, it has robbed me of my youth. My skin shrivels with every scratch of the pen. The manuscript, it could be nothing else."
Nathaniel was taken aback.
"A manuscript? Well, possibly. But let me make myself clear—"
"I have been sworn to secrecy," Mr. Kafka continued. "I have been threatened with death. But what do I care now? Once was quite enough. Twice, that is impossible for any single man. See how my energy has withered."
He held up his bound wrists against the light. They were stick-like and shaking, the skin so thin the light shone through between the bones.
"That is what he has done to me. Before this I burned with life."
"Yes, but what—"
"I know exactly who you are,"
the man continued, speaking over my master as if he did not exist.
"An agent of the British government. I expected you in time, though not, I admit, someone so young and hopelessly inexperienced. If you had arrived a month ago, you might have saved me. As it is, it means little enough. I care not."
He gave a heartfelt sigh.
"It is behind you, on the table."
The boy looked back, reached out, and picked up a paper. As he did so, he cried out in sudden pain, dropped it instantly.
"Ah, it's charged! A trick!"
"Don't show your youth and inexperience," I said. "You're embarrassing me. Can't you see what that is? Anyone with eyes could tell you it's the center of all the magical activity in Prague. It's no wonder it gave you a shock. Use that poncy handkerchief in your pocket and study it more closely. Then tell me what it is." I knew already, of course. I'd seen such things before. But it did me good to see that trumped-up boy shivering with fright, too startled to disobey my instructions, wrapping his hand in his flouncy kerchief, and picking the document up again with the utmost care. It was a large-scale manuscript, cut from calfskin, no doubt stretched and dried in accordance with the old methods, a thick, creamy parchment, beautifully smooth and crackling with power. This power came not from the material, but from the words upon it. They were written in an unusual ink, equal parts red and black. I speculate that these symbolize the power of earth, black, and the blood of the magician, red, which gives that earth its life. But this is only speculation. I am not privy to golem magic. And flowed beautifully from right to left, from the base of the page up towards the top, line upon line of intricate, calligraphic runes. The boy's eyes were wide with wonder. He sensed the artistry, the labour that had gone into this work, even if he could not read the marks. Perhaps he would have articulated this astonishment if he'd been able to get a word in. But the magician, old Kafka, was still singing like a canary, good and true.
"It isn't finished yet," he said. "You can see that. Another half line needs to be added. A full night's work before me. A night that will be my last in any case, since he will surely kill me if the ink itself does not drain my blood. You see the space at the top, that small square box? His employer will write his own name there. That is the only blood he needs to expend to control the creature. It works out very well for him. Oh, yes, less so for poor Kafka."
"What is his name?" I asked. Best to get right to the point, I find.
"The employer?"
Kafka laughed, a harsh sound, like an insane old bird.
"I do not know. I have never met him."
The boy was still staring at the manuscript in a daze.
"This is for another golem," he said slowly. "It'll be put in its mouth to animate it. He's giving the paper his lifeblood, which will feed into the golem."
He looked up at Kafka with horrified wonder on his face.
"Why are you doing this?" he asked. "It's killing you."
I made an urgent gesture. "That's not what we need to know," I said. "We've got to find out who. Time's running out, and dawn's not far off." But the magician was talking again, a faint dullness in his gaze, suggesting he no longer saw us clearly.
"Because of Karl, of course," he said, "and Mia. I have been promised their safe return if I create these things. You must understand that I do not believe this, but I cannot give up the one small hope I have. Perhaps he will honor it, perhaps not. Probably they are already dead."
He broke into a hideous, racking cough.
"In truth, I fear this must be so."
The boy was blank.
"Karl? Mia? I don't understand."
"They are the only family I have," the magician said. "How sad it is they have been lost. It is an unjust world, but when you are offered a chink of light, you climb towards it. Even you, a cursed Briton, must understand that. I could not ignore the only chance I had to see their faces again."
"Where are they, your family?" Nathaniel asked.
"Ha!"
The magician stirred at this. A brief light flared in his eyes.
"How do I know? Some godforsaken prison ship? The Tower of London? Or are their bones already burned and buried? That is your province, English boy. You tell me. You are from the British government, I suppose?"
My master nodded.
"The person you seek wishes your government no good."
Kafka coughed again.
"But then you know this. That is why you are here. My government would kill me if it knew what I had done. They do not want a new golem created, in case it brings another Gladstone down on Prague, wielding that terrible staff."
"I take it," the boy said, "that your relatives are Czech spies. They went to England."
The magician nodded.
"And were captured. I heard nothing of them. Then a gentleman came calling, said his employer would restore them to me, alive, if I revealed the secrets of the golem, if I created the necessary parchment. What could I do? What would any father do?"
Uncharacteristically, my master was silent. Uncharacteristically, I was too. I looked at Kafka's emaciated face and hands, his dulling eyes, saw in them the endless hours pored over his books and papers, saw him pouring his life into the page on the small off chance that his family might be returned to him.
"The first parchment I completed a month ago," Kafka said. "That was when the messenger altered his demands. Two golems were required now. In vain I argued that it would kill me, that I would not live to see Mia and Karl again. Ah, he is cruel. He would not listen."
"Tell us about this messenger," the boy said suddenly. "And if your children are alive, I will return them to you. I guarantee it."
The dying man made a great effort. His eyes focused on my master. Their dimness was replaced by a searching strength. He appraised Nathaniel carefully.
"You are very young to be making such promises," he whispered.
"I am a respected member of the government," Nathaniel said. "I have power."
"Yes, but can you be trusted?" Kafka gave a heavy sigh.
You are British, after all. I will ask your demon."
He did not look away from Nathaniel as he spoke.
"What do you say? Is he trustworthy?"
I puffed out my cheeks, blew hard.
"Tricky one. He's a magician. By definition, he'd sell his own grandmother for soap. But he's marginally less corrupt than some of them. Possibly. A bit."
Nathaniel looked at me. "Thanks for that ringing endorsement, Bartimaeus."
"You're welcome."
But rather to my surprise, Kafka was nodding.
"Very well. I leave it to your conscience, boy. I will not live to see them in any case. In truth, I am worn away. I care not a fig for you or him. You can go on tearing each other's throats out until all Britain lies ravaged. But I will tell you what I know, and let that be an end."
He began to cough weakly, his chin low against his chest.
"Be assured of one thing. I will not complete this manuscript now. You will not have two golems enlivening the streets of London."
"Now, that is a pity," a deep voice said.